times, I think, depending on translation. And so the writer is going to bring that up in several different ways to get us to think about how we're doing in that regard. But Steve is going to open us up in a word of prayer. Let me just start out with this question. What is endurance, or what does it mean to endure? What would you guys say about that? Or y'all, whatever. Continue through hardship? Good. What else? Yeah. Yeah, pressing on? Anything else? Did we already nail it on the head? Yeah. Okay, good. So it involves looking towards the end at something, right? And that allows you to go through the momentary pain. Anything else you guys want to say about that? All right, so that's what we're going to be talking about with Hebrews 12, and we're going to see why they have to endure and what are the hard things that are happening in their life that they have to go through. And here's a reminder of the overly simplified outline of Hebrews. You could say, generally speaking, the first 10 chapters of Hebrews is showing you Jesus' superiority, and it's giving you doctrine or teaching about Jesus' superiority over angels, Moses, priests, and sacrifices. And then around chapter 11, maybe you could say at the end of chapter 10, but let's just say around chapter 11 here, you've got the shift in the book to dealing with the discipline that Christians need to engage in. And it's giving us encouragement to be people that endure. And so this section in chapter 12, in some ways, it is the heart of these ideas of endurance. And so that's what we're going to be looking at this morning. All right, can you guys, just by way of reminder, tell me about the audience? What do we know about the audience of Hebrews? Yeah, they're going through persecution. This is not like the other letters of the New Testament that begin by telling us who the author and the receiver is. So as we read the book, we kind of pick up details about the audience. And so in chapter 10, I think we get the most information that we have about the audience, that they have had their property seized, they've been publicly exposed to taunting and mocking and stuff like that. What else do we know about the audience? What hasn't happened to them? And we're going to see it in our text this morning. Now, they haven't been martyred yet. He's going to say that in our text this morning in verse 4. So they haven't been killed, but they've been experiencing a lot of societal pressure against them for them to give up the faith and to change their views on things like that. Chapter 10, we also know that some of them had not been assembling together. It had become the habit of some, he says in that text. And so the letter, the reason that the letter was written was so that they would have encouragement, I think so that they could stay strong in the midst of the trials. And some people say that the book of Hebrews is actually an ancient sermon because it doesn't begin with the author and the audience and everything like that. It just kind of gets right into it. And at the end of it, he says that I've written this as an encouragement. So some people think Hebrews is actually the only fully complete sermon that we have in the New Testament. And that might be true, that there's probably some reason, room for debate on that one. All right, so what we're going to look at this morning, verses 1 through 3, the writer is going to tell us to endure the race. And then in verses 4 through 11, he's going to tell them to endure discipline. And finally, he's going to deal with the community and enduring together. The book of Hebrews does a lot with community and the importance of being with one another. It's not just in chapter 10 that he does that. And so he does it in chapter 3. He does it in chapter 10. We're going to see it in chapter 13 as well. And so we're going to see a little bit of that, but we'll expand more on that when we get to chapter 13. All right. Any comments or questions about that? Okay, let's go ahead and start out with verses 1 through 3. Jason, do you want to read those?
Therefore, we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and he has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him who endured such hostility from sinners against himself, lest you become weary and discouraged in your souls.
All right, let's start out just by, as you look at these first three verses here, just think first of all, what instructions or what commands is the writer giving the audience here? And I want to think about the first one when he says, let us lay aside every weight and sin. Do you remember in chapter 10 when he says, because we have this high priest, since we have, let us, and then he does the three let us commands. There's going to be two let us commands in this verse, in verse 1. And so he says, let us lay aside every weight and sin. Now, I have a question about this. What are some differences that you can think of between weights and sins? Yeah. Okay, good. So weights would be things that worry us and consume us, but we can't necessarily affect change in it right now. What else would you guys say about this question? Yeah, Christy? Okay, good. So a weight might be like an extra obligation, but it's distracting you from the things that matter most. Good. What else would you guys say about the differences? Steve? Okay, good. Good. What else? Mason? Okay. Okay, good. Good. Anything? So, sin, is sin wrong? Okay, are weights inherently wrong? Maybe not. I mean, let's think about different things that, let's say that you're trying to run a marathon, because this is sort of the imagery that he's giving here. Have you ever seen, okay, so Samantha ran a marathon, and when she ran a marathon, she did not have, like, those vests with weights on them. Have you ever seen people run with those? It's like, why do you do that? I mean, they have got their reasons, but I wouldn't do that. A sin is something that we know from the Bible is something we should not be doing. That stops us in our tracks, like Mason said. But a weight, I think, could be anything that starts to weigh more on our hearts than God. So give me some examples of things that maybe you've seen, or maybe this has happened in your life, where you know that you've started to slow down in your endurance for the Lord because you started to get weighed down and distracted by something that wasn't inherently wrong. And it maybe even if a Christian challenged you and said, hey, I think that this is starting to mean a little bit too much to you, you might get a little defensive and go, well, it's not like this is wrong. Well, it's becoming wrong because of what it's doing to you, what you're allowing it to do to you. So what would be some examples of weights? Yeah. Okay. All right. Relationships? Your health? What was that? Career? Yeah. Sports? Is that a big thing in the South? I don't know. I don't think I'm supposed to joke about that. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, good. What Michelle said as well. Children? Yeah, that I can understand that one. What was that? Your age? Okay. Okay, good. So we think of a lot of things that we have to think about. Okay, are these things starting to wear on me? And maybe I need help from other people to deal with some of these things. Or maybe it's gotten to the point of where it's actually an idol in my life, which it doesn't apply to everything that was just mentioned. But maybe this thing has become so important to me that it's starting to choke the fruitfulness of the word, like the parable of the soils would bring up. All right, so he's telling us in this text to lay aside every weight and sin. Now, there's some of those things that were just mentioned that we can't necessarily lay aside. So here he's bringing up things that we have the ability to remove from our life or to make less important in our life. Notice what he says about the weight and sin, though. It says that they cling closely to us. I don't know. I can't think of a good illustration of something that clings closely. Maybe a kid that's always at your legs or something that's like always walking around you, and you turn around and you accidentally hit him over or something like that. Like it's always right there. So when he says that the weights and sins are clinging closely, I think he's saying here that in order to lay these things aside, it's going to require diligent perseverance to make sure that you keep it at bay, because it keeps wanting to come back. All right, so that's the first instruction that he gives here. Lay aside these things, yeah? That ensnare us or clings closely. Okay, good, good. Anything else you guys want to say about the first instruction here? All right, notice the second one in verse 1. So the first one, you lay aside every weight and sin, and then the next one is you run with endurance. Do you notice the connection between these two things? What if I don't lay aside every weight and sin? Am I able to fulfill the second instruction? No. The only way that I can endure is when the weights and the sins are removed. Because if I keep running with that vest that has all the weights in it, I can maybe run a mile with that or something. I mean, I can't even do that probably. But somebody that knows how to run, they probably can't run very far with that. So if you remove those things, then you're able to actually endure. And I want you to notice what the writer of Hebrews is saying here. That this race that we're running is more important than any weight or sin that you could think of in your life. Like anything you're tempted to put above God, none of those things are as important as God, and that's why they need to be laid aside. All right, so those are the instructions that he gives here. We're going to see the encouragement that he gives them to fulfill that in just a minute. But does anybody have anything else they want to add to these instructions that he gives them? All right, notice then the encouragement that he gives here. He begins in verse 1 by saying, since we have such a great cloud of witnesses. Now, in the context of Hebrews 12, what did he just talk about in Hebrews 11? The faithful people from the Old Testament, right? So I think when he says that you've got this cloud of witnesses, he's talking about all of these Old Testament saints and the example that they were in faith and how that's kind of like a cloud that's surrounding you. And this idea of being surrounded, I think, is related to the Colosseum imagery, where it was a circular sort of thing. You'd be in for the games or whatever, and there would be people surrounding you all over the place, watching you. And here he's saying that you've got these people from the Old Testament and the faithful examples that they had there. And all of these people, in a sense, are sort of cheering you on, is the idea, I think. And I think reflecting on that is something that the audience is supposed to gain encouragement from. Anything you guys want to say about the faithful cloud of witnesses? Yeah, that's good. Okay, good. And consider too, on Wednesday night when we ended the Hebrews 11 class, we talked about how all of the saints from the Old Testament, they had less than what the New Testament Christian has. Because we have the full revelation of God, we have the sacrifice of Jesus, we have the things that the book of Hebrews says are better. And so if these people in the Old Covenant can testify or witness to us by the kind of faith that they had when they had less than we do, how much more encouragement should we gain from those people that were faithful who had less than we do? So very good. Steve? Okay, that's maybe another good way to think about that imagery. Very good. All right, anything else you guys want to say about that? Let me, I don't know if I should say it or not. All right, so, no, I'm not going to. All right, anything else you guys want to say about that? All right. I got to tell us now? Do I have to? All right. So one thing I've heard more and more people say about Old Testament stories is that we don't necessarily look at them as examples of faith. We look at them to see what God did through them, and I totally agree with that statement. But I think sometimes that gets emphasized to the neglect of the idea that they actually are examples of faith. They still are. And Hebrews 11 shows us that. So we should draw encouragement and inspiration from people who really lived, that really went through things. Was God the one working through them? Absolutely. But the New Testament also tells us that these were faithful people that we should gain inspiration from. So, yes, it was God working through them, but we don't just look at what we learn about God in those stories. We learn that there were real people that actually endured these things. By God's help, I'm not trying to neglect either one of these things, but I've just heard more and more people go, I think, far to the other side, where maybe we sometimes miss that these were real people that really did have the determination to live the way that they should. So there you go, I said it. All right, so notice the second thing that he says here. Looking to Jesus. I think Jesus is sort of pictured here as the finish line. And so as you keep looking to him, and by the way, Hebrews is going to say several times throughout the book, fixing your eyes on Jesus, looking to Jesus. This goes back to, I'm sorry, what's your name? The one that said at the beginning that there's a finish line. Yeah, Marissa, sorry. What Marissa said at the beginning about that there's a finish line, there's a goal in mind. And if you're thinking about that, then you're going to be able to endure. Notice something, a couple things about this looking to Jesus, though. In verse 3, it talks about how Jesus endured hostility against himself. All right, just think about this for a moment. I think the writer of Hebrews wants us to think about the kinds of hostility that Jesus endured. So just try to think for a moment. What are some of the hard hostilities that Jesus endured in the Gospels? Just start naming them as they come to your mind. Okay, coming to earth would be pretty hard. What else? By the way, have all of us come to earth? Has it been pretty hard? Yeah. Okay, good. Temptation in the Garden of Gethsemane. What else? Okay, good. Accused of breaking the law, accused of being a rebellious kind of person. What else? Yeah. Okay, good. Yeah, his parents didn't understand his purpose fully. Ebenezer? Say that again. Okay, good. So opposition from the Pharisees and the religious leaders. Very good. What else? He was killed for his faithfulness. That's a lot of hostility. Yeah, Mike? Right. Good. Have you ever had a Bible study with somebody who had different views on things and they said, well, what you're actually teaching is like satanic. Like this is deluding people's minds and all of these different kinds of things. Jesus went through similar kinds of things. Anything else you guys can think of? Yeah. Okay, good. Misrepresented? What else? Yeah. Yeah, so physical beatings. What about his friends? When he was in the Garden of Gethsemane, what did all of his best friends do? They left him. Have you ever felt lonely before? Like, so you think about all the suffering that Jesus went through. I think the writer of Hebrews is saying, go back and think about these kinds of things that this real human being endured. And when you consider that Jesus went through all of these things for us, then that should give us encouragement to lay aside every weight and sin and keep running. So we're supposed to gain encouragement by the fact that he knows what it means to suffer. All right, something else that we learn about Jesus here, though. It says in verse 2, looking to Jesus, who for the joy that was set before him, endured the cross, despising the shame. What was the joy that was set before Jesus that helped? So I guess when he was on the cross and he was dealing with hostility, one of the things that he kept thinking about, I guess, according to this verse, was that there's going to be joy after all of this. There's going to be a greater joy that I'm going to experience. All right, so what would that joy be? You get to go back home. John 17 talks about how he's going to be glorified with the Father like he was before he ever came here. So that's part of it. Anything else? Yeah. Okay, fulfilling his purpose? Good. Yeah, I think Jesus died, and in everything that he did, what did he gain that he didn't have before? Yeah, the church, a bride. And so Jesus is the prince, the knight in shining armor that comes and saves the woman that was in distress. I mean, that it's not a fairy tale, though. This is the real story. He saves a bride for himself by the suffering that he goes through. I have to think that part of the joy that was set before him was knowing that he would have us, which then means that the joy set before us is knowing that we get to be with him. Russ? Yeah. Yeah, good. In chapter 2, when he talks about bringing many sons to glory, do you think God's excited about glorifying us and transforming us and making us beautiful and everything? What does Ephesians 5 talk about? That he cleanses us with the washing of the water by the word so that he might present to himself a blameless bride, however it's worded. That's the idea, though. And so that's what God wants to do with us. Do you think that excites him? Do you think that was part of the joy set before him was you? And apparently when Jesus was going through the hostilities, that was part of what he was thinking about. So I think that's encouraging there. All right, anything else you guys want to say about running the race? Yeah. Yeah, good. Ephesians talks about how he's gaining an inheritance in the church and stuff like that. So good. Yeah, Steve? Right, yeah, that's good. Yeah, Deanna? Right. Right. And so accomplishing it, yeah. Yep. I'm sorry, I didn't catch all that. Your version says the race marked out for us. Yeah, I think the idea is that there's a path that's been set for us, and the path is to follow God no matter what the trials are, and that's what he's calling them to do, I think would be the idea. All right, let's look at verses 4 through 11 then. Here he's going to talk about enduring discipline, which maybe all of this gets interrelated with what we just looked at anyways, but do you want to read verses 4 through 11?
You have not yet resisted to bloodshed, striving against sin, and you have forgotten the exhortation which speaks to you as to sons. My son, do not despise the chastening of the Lord, nor be discouraged when you are rebuked by him. For whom the Lord loves, he chastens and scourges every son whom he receives. If you endure chastening, God deals with you as with sons. For what son is there who a father does not chasten? But if you are without chastening, of which all have become partakers, then you are illegitimate and not sons. Furthermore, we have had human fathers who corrected us, and we paid them respect. Shall we not much more readily be in subjection to the Father of spirits and live? For they indeed for a few days chastened us as seemed best to them, but he for our profit, that we may be partakers of his holiness. Now no chastening seems to be joyful for the present, but painful. Nevertheless, after it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it.
All right, this is a great passage dealing with the nature of God's discipline and the purpose of it and all of this sort of thing. So let's think, first of all, okay, if you were to scan these verses here and try to ask this question, what is the nature of God's discipline? Well, we know in verse 11 that God's discipline is momentarily painful, but later it yields benefits that we'll talk about in just a little bit. But contrast this in chapter 11 when it talks about the momentary pleasures of sin. But that brings lasting troubles. By way of contrast, you've got God's discipline that's momentarily painful, not pleasurable, but it's good in the long run. And so that's one thing to say about the nature of God's discipline. But also, in verses 6 through 9, God's discipline stems from His love for us as children. Have you ever seen kids before that mom and dad never disciplined? They never told them that they couldn't do what they wanted to do and all of these different kinds of things. Do you start to wonder, do those parents even love those kids? I've heard stories about kids that, some of them are never disciplined, and then they look at other kids that are disciplined, and they start to wonder if their mom and dad even loves them. And so, I think when we see what the discipline is in just a moment, people might think, okay, I feel like these are really hard circumstances in my life, or these things are really challenging right now. I wonder if God doesn't really actually love me. And in this text, he says, if you're being disciplined by God, that's actually a sign that you're a legitimate child and he's trying to train you up. And so God's discipline, is God willing to bring momentary pain into our lives out of love to discipline us? Isn't that what mom and dad do when they discipline their kid? You can't play with the Play-Doh right now because you can't throw it in the toilet, so we're not going to let you play with that for a while. And then the kid starts crying and they don't understand why. And there's actually reasons that they're incapable of understanding in that moment why that pain has to be part of their life. Does that ever fit our life? There's things that we've gone through that are really hard. We don't know why. But there's some reason that God has that we might not understand right now. All of those different kinds of things. All right, so that's the nature of God's discipline. I want to think about this question, though. What are the varieties of God's discipline? So mom and dad, they've got different ways to discipline a kid, right? Sometimes it's taking a toy away. Sometimes it might be corporal punishment. So, whatever your preferences are, I don't know. Just do it the right way. Marissa? Okay, good. Isn't that when parents go to the store with the kids and the kids are asking for a toy, for a toy, for a toy? Even if you have the money in the moment and you could do it, there's times where you just have to say no so that they learn that they can't get whatever they want. Would it be reasonable that God would say no sometimes to prayer so that we learn things that we need to learn through that, maybe? Any other ideas on the varieties of God's discipline? What was that? Okay. Okay. Okay, good. So taking away the things that you're tempted to trust in this world. Good. In verse 4, He says, in your struggle against sin. Do you think God could have created a world where struggling against sin would actually not really be a struggle, but it would be pretty easy? Could God have made sin to be disgusting and heinous to all of us, just kind of like injected our minds in that way so that none of us are ever naturally attracted to sin? Could he have done that? If we're going to fight against sin, it's a struggle. And I think part of that struggle is part of God's discipline in our life is, are we going to put effort into these things that we know we need to put to death in our life? But in the context of Hebrews, what do you think the discipline is? And maybe part of it is what verse 4 says about struggling against sin. But think about the wider picture of Hebrews. What's going on with the audience? Persecution. Do you think that those trials are part of God's discipline in this book? Which are things that are in some ways outside of your control. Now, if you were to give up your faith, you wouldn't be going through this discipline anymore. So there's a degree to which you have some control over it. But these are things that God is allowing people to go through in order to train them. Now, this isn't just general suffering in life. This is suffering specifically because you're a Christian. And I think there's a difference between those things. But Mike, were you going to say something? Yeah, I don't necessarily see that God sees, okay, there's this problem in this person's life, and so therefore we have to... I think this is just generally what he's allowing them to go through for their growth, I think would be the idea. Yeah, Ronnie? Yeah, that's good. Anything else? Yeah, Russ? Yes. It reminds me of Romans 5, where he talks about we rejoice in our sufferings and we rejoice, all these surprising things that they can rejoice about. And one of the things that he says in Romans 5 is that the suffering that we go through produces hope. Well, how does that work? Let's say that I put my hope in career and then 2008 stock market crash happens. And then I shift over to putting my hope in, I don't know, think of all the things that people can oftentimes put their hope into and just fill that in your mind. And then that lets you down. And then what eventually should that do for somebody that's being thoughtful about the nature of life? Maybe I need to put my hope in something that won't let me down. What suffering does is it kind of collapses the things that we would be tempted to trust in. And so, is this part of what's happening with the audience of Hebrews? Has the writer of Hebrews talked about hope throughout the book? Maybe they put hope in being accepted in this world, and all of these people that are bringing this persecution into their life is helping them learn that I can't put my confidence in what the world thinks about me. You know, whatever. But you can see how that would all apply to us, though, especially in the culture that we live in and stuff like that. So, maybe something else to say about the varieties of God's discipline. If there's external trials that we might not have control over, I think there are certain disciplines that we can have control over, like how much I pray, how much I study, how much I engage in these things that God has commanded me to do that are a means to an end. And we'll talk about what the end is in just a moment. But anything else you guys want to talk about with the varieties of trials? All right, then, let's ask this question. What is God's purpose through the discipline? And I can find two things, at least in this text, that tell us what God's purpose is for it. So in verse 10, it's to make us holy. Or the way he says it here is so that we can share in his holiness. What does it mean to be holy? Set apart. Does anybody know the first time in the Bible we read the word holy? It's Genesis chapter 2. When God rested on the seventh day. So try to imagine this. You got day one, God does something. Day two, God does something. Three, four, five, six, God is doing something and there's things being created. And then the seventh day is completely different from the rest of them. So if people look at you at work and they say, okay, well, here's this non-Christian coworker, here's this other person, here's this, and then they look at you, is there something completely different about you? Are you really set apart for God's purposes? So the thing that helps us with that is going through trials, external circumstances. And again, this is, I think, in the context of Hebrews, this is specifically suffering on account of being a Christian. But notice the second thing, that it makes us bear fruit. This reminds me in John chapter 15 when Jesus talks about pruning a tree that bears fruit so that it can bear more. Do you think if a tree could talk, if it was like an ent from Lord of the Rings, and you started pruning it, what do you think it would say? Ouch. But is it good for it? It ends up allowing it to be able to bear more and more fruit. And you think about the times in your life that you've gone through suffering. Afterwards, were you better equipped? Were you humbled? Were you Did you learn things from angles that you needed to learn them to know how to help people in a more effective way? And then afterwards, you can understand, okay, that might have been why God let me go through all of that. All right, anything else you guys want to say about the purposes of God's discipline? Yeah, Ebenezer? Yeah. That's very good. 1 Peter chapter 1 is a beautiful passage about our faith being like impure gold that needs to be purified. All right, so those are the purposes of the trials. And then think about our response that we need to have to the trials to make that happen. Because can you have somebody that goes through what could be considered discipline, but they actually don't come out more holy and they don't come out bearing more fruit? Have you seen people go through hard things, and then they just become bitter, angry people at the world and everybody else around them. All right. How do we make sure that that doesn't happen? Notice what he tells them in this passage. He says in verse 5, quoting from Proverbs, he says, "Don't regard lightly the discipline of the Lord." Or some versions might say, "Don't despise the discipline of the Lord." How would you know if you're regarding discipline lightly? You're not taking it seriously? What else? You're not learning from it? So you're not like meditating on what could I be learning through this right now? You're not conscious of those kinds of things? All right, so if one side is don't regard it lightly, the other side, don't be weary either. This means that when God sends discipline into our life, we could be tempted to become weary and give up in the midst of that. Now, that's not God's goal in it. That would be Satan's goal in it. But to be weary, I think, is where the audience is. And then also in verse 7, to endure, it's for discipline that you have to endure. So to endure, I think of Atlas, the Greek god that is holding up the whole world, and he has to bear up under the pressure. There might be things in your life that are really, really challenging, and you're thinking about committing sin for momentary pleasure, like chapter 11 would talk about. That's one of the reasons why I think letters that are written to churches that are suffering keeps talking about holy living, like 1 Peter. Well, why does 1 Peter talk about Christian morality so much? Because if you're suffering, what is a momentary kind of way that you can experience some pleasure? Well, it's by committing sin. And so, in the midst of all of this, you endure, which means you don't ever justify sin. How do you know if you have Christian endurance? It's if, in the midst of hardships, you don't justify sin for momentary pleasure. That's how you know. All right, so that's what I have to say about the discipline part here. Anything else you guys want to add to that? Yeah. Right. Yeah, very good. Anything else you guys want to say about that? Yeah, Jason? Right. Yeah, it hasn't been as bad as what Jesus went through yet. But by the way, when he says that you're going to be reproved, have you ever heard a sermon where you're like, oh, I think the preacher was just really mad at me today, or something? Like, it was really hard to hear that or whatever. Could that be one of the ways that God actually shows love towards you? Is by hearing things that are, I'm not saying that you're being intentionally ugly in the way that you say it or whatever, but things that are really hard that make you reflect about where you are spiritually. Second Timothy chapter 4 talks about there's a time where people will not endure sound teaching. Do you know what that implies about sound teaching? That it's hard. That's why you have to endure it. And so, we got to be careful about those kinds of things. Steve? All right, we're running out of time, so let's talk about 12 through 17. Jason, do you want to read that?
Therefore, strengthen the hands which hang down and the feeble knees, and make straight paths for your feet, so that what is lame may not be dislocated, but rather be healed. Pursue peace with all people and holiness, without which no one will see the Lord. Looking carefully, lest anyone fall short of the grace of God, lest any root of bitterness springing up cause trouble, and by this many become defiled. Lest there be any fornicator or profane person like Esau, who for one morsel of food sold his birthright. For you know that afterward, when he wanted to inherit the blessing, he was rejected. For he found no place for repentance, though he sought it diligently with tears.
All right, we're probably not going to have time to talk about all this, but notice the first main instruction here. He says to lift your hands and strengthen your knees. Anybody know what Old Testament passage he's alluding to when he says this? This is Isaiah 35, and it's an allusion specifically to verse 3. I don't know why there's a lot of Bibles that don't put that as a footnote there, but in Isaiah 35, anybody know what the context of this is? What had the nation been going through, and what's going to happen? All right, I'll just say it. So Israel had gone through hardships by being exiled, and they were going through that kind of discipline. But in Isaiah 35, God's going to make a way of holiness where there's going to be people that were lame that are able to walk. There's people that were blind that are going to be able to see. God is going to reverse the situation that they're going through, and he's going to make things better. This fits the audience of Hebrews. They're going through trials, but this text, chapter 11, chapter 10, has been talking about this reward that's ultimately going to make everything that's sad become untrue, to quote Lord of the Rings. Those are the sorts of things that I think would be parallel from Isaiah 35. So he brings that up to them. But this idea of lifting the weak hands and strengthening the feeble knees, this could be applied to an individual. Like, you might have parts of your life that are getting out of joint and could get completely dislocated. But it could also apply to a body of believers. Could we have members here that are starting to get dislocated from the body? And how can we be looking out for one another and helping one another so that we're all on this way of holiness that leads to a reversal of all the things that we go through in this life? Any comments or questions about that? All right. From verses 14 through 17, he's just going to bring various instructions, a lot of them dealing with how we relate to other people. So he says, pursue peace with everyone. I think that would imply even the non-Christians that are persecuting them. Pursue holiness. He talks about this root of bitterness. And the way that the NLT begins it, he says, look out for one another, that nobody fails to obtain the grace of God. That you see, make sure that there's no roots of bitterness springing up from other people. What is a root of bitterness? If we went to, let's talk about pruning again. So if we have an apple tree in our front yard, if I cut off like a couple of the branches, would the root still be there? Do you think sometimes we as Christians can kind of do behavior modification where, I think I came across like I was bitter, and I better not come across like that anymore, without actually thinking about if that really came from my heart or not? The way that you get rid of the roots of bitterness is not by cutting off branches and pruning. It's by actually being introspective and seeing who you are from the inside out. And so there's a lot of great things we could say about that that we don't have time to. Jason? Okay, good. And a root, by the way, affects the rest of the tree. So if you're interconnected with other people and you start to get involved in bitterness, remember in Hebrews chapter, Numbers chapter 11, when the Israelites start grumbling, do you remember what God sends all around them? Fire. Why is fire in the context of grumbling? Maybe, this is my stab at it, maybe there's no connection, but maybe grumbling spreads like fire. And that's what was happening in the camp of the Israelites. And so God sends this ring of fire all around them. And so you start influencing other people when you're bitter or when you're complaining. And so if we see it in this spot, the rest of the tree could be affected by it as well. Anything else you guys want to say about the root thing? All right. And then he says, don't be like Esau, which is opposite of chapter 11, where you had all these faithful people. Here's an example of somebody from the Old Testament that wasn't faithful. He gave up his future birthright for a momentary pleasure of lentil soup. I hope it was at least a really good bowl. And notice that it says in this text that he sought repentance, or he sought to be able to get the blessings back, but with tears, but there was no chance to repent. Well, that seems kind of mean. I thought God would receive anybody back if they repented. Well, yeah, I think he can't get the blessings back. And I think the idea that he's bringing up here is, will there be a time when if you continually rejected God, that no matter how much sobbing, no matter how much weeping you're experiencing, there really is no changing direction anymore, because your eternity is locked, because you're in hell now? Do you think there's going to be a lot of sobbing and weeping and desiring to repent in that situation? I think that's more the parallel that he's bringing up with Esau. So, all right. On Wednesday, we will talk about the end of chapter 12 and then the beginning of chapter 13. So thanks for the good discussion, everybody.